Hello and welcome to the Counting the Earth podcast from the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. I'm Alice Hope.
And I'm Sue Nelson. Throughout this podcast, we explore the environment and the natural world, but always through the lens of one number.
And today's number is 14. That's the percentage of rivers in England that are rated as being in good ecological health or of good ecological status.
Yes, today we're doing a health check on our rivers. There's already been a lot of focus in the media and from campaign groups on the discharge of untreated sewage into rivers and the risk that poses to open water swimmers. So instead, we wanted to look at all the aspects of river ecology and biology that go into building a full picture of the health of our rivers, the range of measures that are used to calculate that rating of ecological health or status. And helping us to unpick that figure of 14% will be hydrochemist Dr. Mike Bowes, who's going to reveal what that single figure rating might not be telling us.
As well as Dr. Ellie Mackay, who spoke to me about the advances in technology which are making monitoring more efficient and cost-effective. And I also visited the River Kennet in Marlborough, Wiltshire, to explore the delights of river flies.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing about your latest quest to celebrate another invertebrate. River flies are some of nature's, I think it's fair to say, less appreciated creatures. But let's get a description of them first.
Well, river flies are things like mayflies and caddisflies that we see flitting about over the surface of our rivers in the summer, and the sunlight comes through them and they just sort of look beautiful. But the adult's flying stage only lasts days or weeks, and they spend most of their lives as larvae living in our rivers and ponds. These are often quite alien-looking creatures with features that vary from pointed tails to scorpion-like bodies. They look really, really weird. But they are a vital food source for other river dwellers like fish and birds. So a drop in their numbers really impacts the whole ecosystem. And because that waterborne stage is relatively long, around a year or so, and because they're affected by water quality, they're a bit like the canaries in the coal mine, but for river and health.
Now, knowing how you got your hands deep in worms a few podcasts ago, I'm assuming you don't just sit on the riverbank with a picnic and fish for flies.
No, of course not. You know me, I can never turn down an opportunity to get mucky or wet. So I grabbed a net, pulled on my chest waders, and of course got right in the river with Anna Forbes from the Riverfly Partnership. She showed me how to sample for these tiny little invertebrates and told me more about how they're being used as sentinels for river health from Cornwall right through to the Highlands of Scotland.
Okay. Right, if we just climb on down into the river now from the bank.
And now, oh, it's deeper than it looks.
It is quite deep and the flow's quite powerful at the moment. And the water is, as you can still feel through the waders, a bit cold because it's a chalk stream. So whatever the time of year, it's about 10 degrees.
We're up to about sort of mid-thigh height here and it is flowing very fast. We've got a gravel riverbed and there's not a lot of weeds or anything like that. The water is quite clear. I can see all the way down to the bottom. So compared to some other sites, this seems like it might be quite easy to sample because you're not negotiating around lots of obstacles or weeds or anything like that.
Compared to some other sites, this is quite easy to access. There's not too many difficulties. This is the river fly net. So everyone that does river fly monitoring is using the same kit nationally. So this is a really strong net. We put it right on the bottom of that firm gravel riverbed. And then do you want to hold the net for me up here? Just holding it really firmly.
Yeah.
And then I need to stand in front of the net and I'm just going to be kicking and gently agitating the gravel riverbed. So I'm just disturbing the little creatures that live in the gravel. And that's where we're going to find our indicator groups that we're going to be counting. And then we have to move along across the river a little bit, keeping it firmly on the bottom. And I'm just kicking with the bottom of my wader and it's just disturbing that gravel and then moving to another bit to disturb it a little bit more. And you're just trying to get a representation of your river fly site. So if you had weed, you'd be jiggling the net through the weed. If you had riffles, you'd be kicking a bit in the riffles. Slow flow, you'd do a bit through there. Overall, it's a 3-minute kick sample, getting a representation of your stretch of river.
So what species are we looking for in this stretch of river?
So we're looking for three groups plus shrimp. So we're looking for freshwater shrimp. We're also looking for several different mayflies, and we're looking for cased and caseless caddis, and we're also looking for stonefly. So once we've got out on the bank with our 3-minute sample, we'll be pouring them into the big white plastic tray on the riverbank. And I've brought a couple of magnifying glasses along as well, so that we can look and count up those 8 different indicators that we're looking for. And these are indicators because they tell us if the river's healthy or not, because they don't tolerate poor water quality.
And the flow is fast because we've had a lot of rain, not just recently, but also over the winter as a whole. Is that right?
Yeah, last year was a really wet year, and it's continued to be wet. Right up to even yesterday, it was still pouring with rain. In January, we certainly wouldn't have been able to be in this river because the whole of the meadow was flooded, which is what water meadows are for. They're designed to be that big sponge to take that space full of water. We've also got, I should mention, marginal habitat here, because we've got all of the sedge, and there's some flag iris and purple loosestrife, lots of native marginal plants. And we sometimes, what we would also do is jiggle the net around the base, around the root systems, because again, that's part of the different mosaic of habitats here, so that would be included in the sampling as well, because there'll be things living in there that might not be elsewhere. And the other thing we would do also is we do a 1-minute rock check. So that would be because some creatures cling to the rocks, like there's one called a flat-bodied Heptagenidae, and that's a type of mayfly, and it really chunky little legs, and that's because it has to have strong little legs to cling on to those rocks, because it really likes fast flow. So if you don't pick up the rocks, you're far less likely to find those. So again, it's just all the different habitats need to be covered in that 3-minute kick sample. And then the important thing is the volunteers that do that replicate the same each month that they come back to their site, so that the data is really nice and consistent.
So what do river flies tell us about the river?
They can tell us if a serious pollution incident has happened or not, because they're quite long-lived for small creatures, and they are simply not going to be there in the normal numbers if there's something that's happened. So by monitoring every month, you're building up long-term data. And then if something untoward does happen that isn't always visible by just looking at the river, by getting in and doing your kick sampling, working out your score, it will tell you if that stretch of river is healthy or not.
It's interesting you mentioned consistency there, because I was wondering about this process that we're doing. Obviously, Riverfly is not the only organisation that does samples like this. So is the process the same across all of the different organisations that do this kind of sampling?
Yeah, so the Riverfly Partnership have devised this methodology that's being used by all the different other organisations that are carrying out. So nationally, wherever you are, everyone's using the same kit, using the same 3-minute kick sample, looking for the same creatures. And then that data can be used by that individual hub organisation to be able to look and see if there are dramatic decline or are things getting better on certain stretches of river. There's good news in there too. So every month, all that data is sent off to the Environment Agency, unless it's a trigger level breach, in which case we're contacting them immediately.
And when you say a trigger level breach, what does that mean? What might that involve?
So that's when you've done your counting of your invertebrates. It's been converted in a really simple scoring system. And the trigger level breach here, for example, is a 5. And so if it went below the 5, that's when you'd resample. And if it was still below the 5, I would contact the Environment Agency and they would come out and take the sampling further, because it would indicate there's something wrong with the river health if it was down below the 5. Some sites are really good, and if they went down from being a 12 all the time to something like a 7, even though it's not a trigger level breach, we would still contact the EA, because for that site, if you've got years of data and you suddenly notice this dip, there's probably going to be a reason for it. Overall, we've got 68 trigger level breaches nationally that have been picked up through this initiative. So it's a really successful citizen science of picking up otherwise undetected pollution incidents. It's filling in gaps as the Environment Agency. They have less and less funding to get out and do this kind of thing themselves.
What is the Riverfly Partnership? How did it start?
So the Riverfly Partnership started off, it was called the Anglers Riverfly Monitoring Initiative, because it was a group of concerned anglers that could see a decline in fly life. And so it's evolved over the years, and now it's a mixture of anglers, conservationists, scientists, landowners, all kinds of different people, but all with that common interest of wanting to monitor the health of the river. So the Riverfly Partnership is that national overarching body that oversees, collects all that data from all the different hubs and individuals from all over the country and collates it.
The data is all collected by volunteers. How many volunteers do you have across the country?
So the Riverfly Partnership has 1,300 registered users that input data to the database.
The number we're focusing on for this episode is 14, because 14% of England's rivers meet good ecological status. So what is the picture of river health that the Riverfly Partnership is seeing across the country?
So overall, I'd say the health of the river from this is not great. There's an awful lot of water quality issues, and these creatures are picking that up because they are sensitive to poor water quality, and different ones of those creatures have different sensitivities. So this is picking up what might be the different problems.
So what kind of pollution events might these organisms be quite sensitive to? Are they all sensitive to different things?
So sometimes there's a crossover where there's things that will affect all of them. We had here at the site you're at today, just downstream from here, we picked up a big pollution incident from an insecticide a few years ago, and that pretty much wiped out all the different indicators. And so that was a big incident that would have gone undetected and actually was prevented from being made worse because of us monitoring, because it was a chemical coming out of a sewage treatment works. And by us reporting this, it then meant that the sewage treatment works stopped discharging. Although it was a quite catastrophic incident, it could have been even worse. Why don't we climb out and go and have a look what we've got?
Fabulous, and we'll go warm up.
I loved hearing the sound of the river behind you there. Very relaxing. And we'll hear more from you and Anna a little later on. But I heard a new word there, riffles. What are riffles?
Yes, it's a lovely word, isn't it? So these are the rocky, shallow parts of a stream where the water flow is quite choppy and broken up. So when you describe a laughing, babbling brook or a melodic, gentle, tumbling chalk stream, that's what we're describing. But when we visited the Kennet, it was in full flow. We were up to our thighs and the current was really strong. So absolutely no hope of any lovely, gentle riffles. It was far too deep.
So you were in peak riffles, right? Now I know I'm going to try and use that word. Now, as you know, I'm rather partial to a citizen science project, having done numerous butterfly and bird counts over the years and one period of time in a field on my knees sexing cowslips. Now, these are usually one-off counts once a year. And we heard there that the Riverfly Partnership has the impressive commitment of 1,300 volunteers across Britain who regularly go out and sample their local stretch of river to build up a more detailed picture of river health over time, producing an invaluable citizen science project. How many of our waterways does that cover?
It's around 450 rivers across Britain. So it was inspiring to hear more about the project, not only for their commitment, but also how the partnership has devised a really rigorous sampling method that dovetails with the sampling of other organisations, such as the Environment Agency in England or Natural Resources Wales, because they are responsible for policing pollution in our waterways. And this is open source data, so anyone can use it, which is really, really helpful. It's so important that all these sources of citizen-generated data are consistent with each other so that the efforts the public make really count and can be used for rigorous science.
And the Riverfly Partnership, they're not the only players when it comes to citizen science in rivers, are they?
No, the Rivers Trust also does a huge amount of work to advocate for our rivers. And they're actually leading on a big £7 million project called CASTCO, or CASTCO, depending on which bit of the country you're in. So it's really trying to make our waterways more resilient for the future, with local people at the heart of that work.
Now, for river flies like caddis and mayflies to thrive, you need clean water. And with all the recent publicity on the increased discharges of raw sewage by water companies, you would imagine our river quality is currently at an all-time low.
Yes, it has sounded pretty dire recently, but to be honest, it's quite a mixed picture. Certainly, rivers and lakes are not as clean as they were pre-industrialisation because heavy industry and coal burning, for example, all impacted our river water quality. But many aspects of water quality have been improving over the past 30 to 50 years, following the decline of heavy industries and the demise of coal burning in the UK, and the introduction of the Urban Wastewater Treatment Directive Initiative in the early 1990s, which brought in massive improvements to the way our wastewater is treated. So we have seen heavy metal pollution and phosphorus levels decrease quite significantly. But that number of just 14% of English rivers being rated as in good ecological health has remained static over the last two decades, despite the reductions I mentioned.
Interesting. Well, to help us dig into this and the complexities of that rating system, I spoke to Dr. Mike Bowes from UKCEH about what other measurements are being done to assess river health. And by the way, if you hear EA mentioned, that's short for the Environment Agency.
Most of the assessments of our rivers are done by our regulatory authority. So that's the Environment Agency in England, NRW in Wales, and SEPA in Scotland. So they take regular samples from a huge number of rivers throughout the UK, and they test not only the insects, the invertebrates, like you've just been hearing about, but they look at the fish populations, the plant populations, and they also take water samples from the rivers and lakes and test them for a whole range of nutrients and pollutants and measure the oxygen concentration in the rivers. And all of this data is combined to establish whether rivers are of good status or not. But there's also lots of things that volunteers like who you've just been meeting with can get involved as well. So there's lots of organisations, local rivers trusts and organisations such as Earthwatch that are enabling people to go out and use small test kits to measure the phosphate and nitrate levels in their local rivers to establish the kind of health of their local river.
Is it the river equivalent of a car's MOT, where you have a sort of set number of tests that you have to do, like the equivalent of an oil change, check the pressure on the tyres, but you have to do that with certain chemicals?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy. But rather than it being annual, traditionally, river water quality has been monitored once a month. Thousands of river sites across the UK, that's since been reduced to about once a quarter in most cases now. For the biological components, so the fish and the plants and the invertebrates, they do them maybe two or three times a year to try and capture the change in communities that are present. Now, unfortunately, the EA have had to reduce their frequency. It's still quite a rigorous test for our rivers to get through.
Let's look at that 14% figure. 14, that's a number that's the basis of this episode. If 14% of rivers are in good ecological health, does that mean then, just doing the maths, 86% of rivers are not in good ecological health?
Mathematically, that is correct. As I was saying, the Environment Agency and SEPA and NRW, they're assessing water quality and all the different types of ecology, the fish, the insects, and identifying whether a particular river is high status, good status, moderate, poor or bad. What they then do, though, they combine all of that data for a particular site. They look for the worst score. So your river gets marked with the worst score. This is called the one-out, all-out principle. So what that means is a particular river might have amazing insects present there, it might have beautiful plants, might have really good water quality, but if it doesn't have the right kind of algae or the right kind of fish, it might score as being bad, but for everything else, it might be of really good ecological status or good water quality. So yeah, that 14% value is a little bit misleading.
Well, we've had some data from the Environment Agency to state that the raw sewage overflows have increased recently. And first of all, why is sewage pumped into rivers in the first place?
We need to distinguish between treated sewage effluent and then these sewage spills. All of our domestic waste that leaves our house via our sinks, baths and toilets goes to water treatment plants, sewage works, and these sewage works treat the effluent to the required legal standard, it then has to go somewhere, and the right place to put it is into the river. So most of our rivers, particularly rivers downstream of any urban settlement, will have a portion of sewage effluent in them. And it's always been the case since the 1880s, 1870s, when we started to design our sewage system. There's nowhere else to put it, really. The River Thames might be 30 or 40% sewage effluent during the summer, but it is treated sewage effluent. Doesn't mean it's safe, but it's treated. So the sewage treatment process not only removes pollutants, but it also tries to remove pathogens as well, but it can't remove them all. So that's the treated effluent. The spills that people are talking about relate to when sewage treatment works are overwhelmed in terms of volume of rainwater, and they have to release untreated effluent that has been diluted by a lot of this rainwater that's been coming down the road drains directly into our rivers. Now, if they're operating correctly, they only operate when it's really heavy rainfall, which means that the rivers will be in high flow and it is further diluted. But there's a higher chance of getting ill when this is happening because the pathogens aren't removed, they're just diluted. They haven't gone through the sewage treatment process.
With climate change, we're obviously going to get more rain, more water into our rivers. Is it too simplistic to think that actually this might be a good thing because more water means that rivers will be more diluted and that could effectively mean lower concentrations of pollutants?
Not at all. No, that's spot on. So we're forecast in the UK to get wetter winters and drier summers. So during the winter, if we've got more water getting into our rivers, the pollutants will be more diluted. But another side to that is that because we're getting more rainfall, we're going to get more washing off of pollutants and nutrients from the land into the rivers. So that will increase the load of pollutants potentially. And the other impact is that more sustained rainfall is more likely to overwhelm greater numbers of sewage works, which means that the water companies will discharge the excess untreated but diluted sewage. And the other impact is that without future water company investment upgrading the capacity of these sewage works, more sustained rainfall is likely to overwhelm our sewage treatment works more often. During the summer, when we're forecast to get drier summers and lower flows, we're expecting to see higher concentrations of phosphate and nitrate in our urbanised catchments. So yes, UKCEH have been working with the Environment Agency to produce predictions of how climate change is going to affect our nutrient concentrations across rivers in the UK. And that's a prediction that potentially it will go down a bit over winter due to that dilution effect, but it's more likely to be a lot more concentrated in the summer periods in the urbanised lowland catchments.
Are there any other solutions that we can put in place that are less technological and more nature-based?
Yeah, there's lots of nature-based solutions that people and organisations are employing to try and improve river ecology and improve the water quality as well. People are reinstating wetlands, they're reintroducing beavers, they're planting trees along river channels. It all has a part to play. There are other simple things that members of the public can do as well. For instance, not paving over your front garden, because that increases the amount of rainwater that's going down our road drains, for instance.
Well, I'm feeling quite smug now because I've got two water butts and had a drive replaced with the permeable materials.
That is excellent.
Thank you very much. I'm feeling incredibly smug. I also live in a small town, almost like a large village, that has a river running through it. And that river is sort of the focal point for people in this summer, love to picnic by them, kids paddle in the river.
You know, I think it's really heartening that people are using their rivers more than they ever did before. I don't think we did as much of it 30 years ago. And I think that tells the story that the rivers are better, but because they're better and people are more engaged with them, I think people are more attuned to when things aren't right. But from the kind of monitoring that UKCEH are doing, we've seen dramatic improvements in our water quality of our monitored rivers, and we see it through monitoring data from the EA and other academic institutes as well. So, for instance, the River Thames, which is often cited as being in a terrible condition, the phosphate concentration has reduced by 85% since the late 1990s. And we know from our research that it happened very suddenly, and it's tied up with Oxford and Swindon sewage works being upgraded. Based on the evidence, the water quality is better, and also based on the biological evidence, the ecological evidence, things are getting better.
So going back to that headline figure of only 14% of rivers being at good ecological status and how that's derived, it's often just one ecological component that's holding back the status score for that river due to that one out, all out principle. But if you look at the individual components, if you look at the individual insect biodiversity scores or plant biodiversity scores or water quality scores, you find that things are getting better in most rivers and generally across the country, things are really improving. Our monitoring data certainly shows that water quality has improved massively in recent years due to policy and infrastructure improvements over the last 20 years. But having said that, more clearly needs to be done. The largest improvements in water quality have occurred mainly in our lowland urbanised rivers. And this has been due to improvements in the sewage treatment works that's serving our large towns and cities. But UKCEH research shows that phosphorus loads in these rivers, despite the improvements, they're still dominated by sewage inputs. So we need to continue to try and drive down these sewage inputs further to improve our ecological status in our rivers across the country. In order to do that, it's really important to understand the sources of pollution. You know, where are these pollutants coming from that are going into our rivers? And to do that, we require specialist monitoring and modelling to provide the evidence. And once we know where the pollution is coming from, that enables us to target these pollutant sources in a more cost-effective way.
In the meantime, is it safe to paddle or swim in our rivers?
You can never say it's safe to swim in any river, really, anywhere in the world. There's always going to be pathogens present, so it's never entirely safe. I think you can minimise your risk, just make some informed choices.
Mike Bowes from UKCEH. So a complex picture indeed. Some wins, but some real challenges. Certainly the extent of combined sewage overflows, the release of untreated sewage into our rivers is a huge issue.
Yes, it is. The latest data from the Environment Agency shows that there were over 3.5 million hours of recorded spills in 2023. Now, that's an increase of over 105% from the previous year. But it's worth remembering that 2022, the year before, was a year of drought, so there was less rainfall to trigger these overflows. Now, these figures came out within the last few months at a time when both the regulator Ofwat and the Environment Agency are carrying out major investigations into illegal sewage dumping by water companies. And it is something that everyone agrees has to be tackled and something the Minister for Water labelled unacceptable.
Mike mentioned there that water companies have to publish data on their sewage discharges. Is this easy to find? And is it in real time so that, for instance, people could use that information to make decisions about whether to go for a paddle in the river on a given day?
Unfortunately, it does depend on where you live. Some water companies release real-time data, but sadly not all of them do. But we will be looking at open water swimming in more depth in a future episode on the Cumbrian Lakes.
Well, I'm dying to hear what you found with Anna Forbes. So let's return to Marlborough and sift through your findings of weird and wonderful creatures in the River Kennet.
I'm going to get the bucket and I'm going to gently pour it into this big white tray so that we can have a better look at what we've collected in the river. As the water settles, you start to see some of the creatures coming out from the gravel. Have a look at this guide. And these are what contribute to the count. We've got cased caddis, caseless caddis, then these four different mayfly, and then we've got stonefly, and then we've got gammarus, freshwater shrimp. But anything else that volunteers know what it is, or as they do it for a long time, we kind of teach them about other creatures too, they then log those under other sightings. So whilst they don't contribute to the score, it's still giving us a bigger picture of what's going on.
I can see lots of little invertebrates swimming around, and it really is sort of teeming with life in there. What is that? That sort of, it almost looks like it's got a collection of gravel stuck to it.
Well done for spotting it. I'm going to take it out and put it in the divider tray. So I'm just with the pipette sucking up some of this cold water and putting it in the tray that's got lots of different sections in it. Because it's got a little case, I'm going to pick it up quickly because it might get stuck in the pipette. So this is called a cased caddis. It's a type of insect because it's got six legs, and it's built that little case. If you look closely, it's lots of little bits of these bits of gravel. So you get some that make their cases out of gravel, some that make it out of bits of wood, and some that use bits of plant. And it's their way of camouflaging themselves, because you can see, if they're not moving, how well they blend in the bottom of the riverbed. But they're one of these creatures, like I say, that if the water quality goes down, their numbers will plummet, or they might end up actually being absent if it's really bad.
Oh, that looks almost alien, doesn't it? It's very odd looking, but you can see its six legs there. It's quite big as well.
It is quite big. And these, again, there's over 200 different species of case caddis. So for ordinary river fly monitoring, volunteers just need to recognise it's a case caddis. They're not going down into the specifics of which species of case caddis. So they have to learn that they can really vary. You can have ones that are smaller than a grain of rice, through to ones even bigger than this one here, because some of the ones that use wood can end up quite chunky, about, you know, 8 centimetres, 9 centimetres long with the wood.
So let's have a look at what else we've got in here.
Can you see that these are swimming around in a pair, because they're busy making more? These are freshwater shrimp, and they can vary in size. And unlike these other creatures that will all eventually hatch out and leave the river, the shrimp is in the river for all of its life. And these are all really important food for creatures further up the food chain. So if these are absent or not around in big enough numbers, that's going to have a knock-on effect for everything else in the food chain.
So if anyone listening wants to get involved, how would they go about doing that?
If they went to the Riverfly Partnership website, that would be the best point to go to initially, and then they would help steer you to if there's an active hub near you, so that you could attend the accredited workshop, get your training, get your kit, and then join part of an existing team. You don't want people setting up sites where there might already be a site that they don't know, so that you can be best placed to really help start monitoring.
Massive thanks go to Anna Forbes there from the Riverfly Partnership for taking me out on the River Kennet, but actually I very much got into the River Kennet, and we'll post a photo of the cased caddis fly we caught onto the UKCH social media channels so that everyone can have a look. I also did really like the gammarus shrimp as well. Apparently they can pair together for weeks at a time, which I think is very impressive.
You kept using the word alien, and you're right, because I took a look at some of the photographs and they do look as if they're either from the movie Avatar or a type of miniature predator.
Yes, they do. They are a bit weird and intimidating looking, but they are also beautiful in their own way.
In their own way. And it's a lovely reminder that not everything that's beautiful in the insect world has to be a butterfly. For anyone keen to support their local river, do go to the Riverfly Partnership website or those of other organisations such as the Rivers Trust to see how you can get involved. Citizen science groups are providing important evidence on the state of our rivers, and it also fosters a sense of commitment to local habitats. Of course, it does require a big time commitment from volunteers, but it sounds incredibly worthwhile.
It is very worthwhile, because if we are going to tackle the problems with our rivers, it's vital that we develop more cost-efficient ways of collecting that long-term data on what's going on in our waterways.
But there'll also be a need for high-tech methods of monitoring our rivers, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. And to shed light on those, I spoke to UKCH freshwater ecologist Dr. Ellie Mackay on an appropriately rainy day when she'd just come back from water sampling in the northwest of England.
There's been lots and lots of advances in various different things as the kind of questions that we ask and try and understand about our freshwaters changes. So that includes things like the development of new sensors that are capable of sensing, maybe things that we've measured in the laboratory at a kind of lower frequency. We now have got sensors that can potentially measure those things at higher frequency. So we talk about nutrients. There are a variety of different sensors coming online now which are able to monitor nutrients in higher frequency. Then there are also novel sensors which are targeting different aspects of the freshwater environment or different pollutants that might be there. Another way that monitoring is changing is how we're measuring those things. So traditionally we take a water sample at a particular point in time, take that back to the laboratory and analyse it. But now there are new techniques coming along which allow us to take integrated samples over longer periods of time or to take samples at really high frequency, and those allow us to ask different questions. Other developments in terms of technologies include things like developments in molecular approaches like eDNA and environmental DNA. So that's where we can take samples of water or different aspects of the lake, like maybe the biofilm that grows on the rocks. And using amplicon sequencing, so DNA analysis, we can look at the huge array of biodiversity that exists in those freshwater environments. So that can be from the microbial community, like the bacteria, the viruses, the fungi in the water, up to the aquatic plants. So that can be the microscopic ones like the algae or macrophyte species, all the way up to the fish and evidence of other DNA coming in from the terrestrial environment. So that might be animals that are using the water, like otters or bird species.
So it allows you to get a really holistic picture of what's going on in the river.
Yeah, and I think there's still work going on now to develop techniques and understanding of how we analyse these data to get that broader understanding. But we can potentially sample a much broader kind of perspective using some of these techniques.
And as well as new approaches, over time, are there new conditions that we're trying to measure in the river, new pollutants or changes that we weren't looking for before?
There's been a lot of attention more recently on trying to understand around impacts of sewage discharges, of things like the combined sewer overflows, of road runoff and those kind of things, and a recognition that there are a whole range of pollutants and chemicals that are coming from different human activities that are ending up in freshwater environments. And so new techniques are being developed to try and target some of those things or to trace where the sources of pollutants are. So the development of things to look for specific markers of things which distinguish sewage pollution, for example, from other things. So detecting things like caffeine or pharmaceuticals that are coming out of human waste and getting into the environment. And so there's lots of development in sensors and technology to try and pick apart some of those complex mixes that end up in the environment.
So as well as new ways of measuring things from inside the river, are there developments to measure things from outside the river?
Yes, so there are remote sensing technologies which are also developing rapidly at the moment in this area. So that's things like the drones that might be flying over water or ones which operate in the water, but also the satellites up in the upper atmosphere and smaller scale versions of those. The resolution of those is improving, and that's allowing us to get much more detail on this kind of spatial variation in some of these different things that we might want to measure, so like water temperature or chlorophyll, indicators of algal growth in the water, and the developments there in kind of multispectral approaches of trying to sense different aspects of the environment.
And presumably it's important that we know where these pollutants are coming from so that then policy can be put in place to reduce them.
Yeah, so what we need to do is to really unpick where some of these pollutants are coming from, what the sources are, to identify what we need to change to reduce the impact that these chemicals and different pollutants might be having on the environment. So yeah, the use of these technologies will be really useful to help inform that understanding of how important particular sources are in the specific context of that river or lake ecosystem.
Freshwater ecologist Dr. Ellie Mackay. Okay, let's remind ourselves of our headline number of 14, as in just 14% of waterways are regarded as being in good ecological health or status. But as we've discovered, there's a bit more to that number.
There is, because while it implies 86% in the less than good category, this monitoring measure is a little bit misleading due to the one out, all out principle, and it paints a bleaker picture than is the case in many rivers. It really is a mixed picture. We have seen some wins over the last decade, such as a big reduction in heavy metal pollution and the return of many species of fish and even otters in some parts of the country. There are still challenges, though, such as the need to reduce phosphorus levels even further and reduce those sewage discharges. And having long-term data is so important to understanding the full picture of any individual river's health, rather than just judging it from snapshots of data from a particular moment. I mean, some of UKCH's records go back to the 19th century.
Oh, that's impressive in itself and may even require its own podcast. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And please do join us next time on Counting the Earth, where we take another look at nature through numbers.